Hello, I'm Clark Ching, and you're listening to the Agile Uprising podcast.
Greetings, and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I am your host, Jay Hursko. Join with me, I have a longtime listener, first-time caller, Mr. Don Idle. Did I say that right, Don?
You said that correctly, yep.
Perfect, perfect. And Don is joining me this week because we're going to talk about a book that we both read that we really got a lot out of, which is Jonathan Smart's Sooner, Safer, Happier, Anti-Patterns and Patterns for Business Agility. So I'm going to start with the simple question to you, Don. What led you to pick up the book?
Honestly, it's because Josh Kiriewski was really big on it for a while. He's somebody that I have a lot of respect for in the Agile community. He just said, you know, this really aligns with my values is what he said. And he put it out there. You know, he's the modern Agile kind of guy. Mm-hmm. I've been a longtime follower of that kind of as a good way of framing some of the things that I value as important. So when he said this kind of aligns directly with the modern Agile principles, better, sooner, safer, happier, right? It's the, like the four different principles. So when he said that, that piqued my interest a little bit, like, I wonder, because personally, I prefer reading stuff that's more principle-based rather than this is how you do it based.
Right, right.
I get boxed in. I'm one of those kind of anti-authoritarian type people, like if you tell me exactly how to do something, I'm going to rebel against that. If you tell me what you're after and why, then my imagination just goes wild and I start experimenting with things.
Right.
So that's what led me to show some interest in the book. And then, you know, on the Discord channels for Agile Uprising, a little plug there, we discussed it a little bit, like, hey, maybe we should talk about this book. And so that's when I picked it up and finally started reading it.
I had kind of the same exposure. So I worked at Barclaycard US many years ago for quite a bit. And there was always rumblings about what was going on over in the UK. And his name came up, you know, they had their agile ways of working, which he leans on a lot in the book that conceptually, sadly, it never made it to us across the pond in the US. And I think we might've been better off if we had, but that's neither here nor there. But I remember seeing this book come up numerous times. And I eventually, you know, it was one of those Amazon purchased it on a whim. Let's give it a go. And actually, I got a lot more out of it. And we were talking about it before we started recording. I got a lot more out of it than I expected. I really did get a lot more out of it than I expected. So let's start with, for those that haven't read the book, Don, let's start with talking about the structure, right? So Jonathan writes this where he starts with an anti-pattern and a pattern. What did you think about that way of laying out the narrative?
At first, I wasn't sure as I was reading it. I thought, is this going to be a helpful way? But in some ways it is because he's using storytelling, right? Mm-hmm. Storytelling is a really powerful tool to get ideas across. So he's saying, this is an anti-pattern and this is what it looks like. And it tells you a story about, you know, too much control versus giving autonomy to teams. And he shares what that looks like in a story format. And so it's easy to identify like, yeah, I've been on that team before. Right, anti-pattern team. So I think it's as I started reading through the book, I started to buy into that concept more to say, yeah, I think that works because of the storytelling aspect. It makes it very clear what he's trying to say, right?
Right.
It's a pattern versus anti-pattern. So this is the ugly, and maybe you self-identify as experiencing the ugly. Here's what it could be. And then, you know, so that's the positive patterns rather than the anti-patterns. And then he says, and here's how you could get there.
Right, right. He doesn't come off as preachy or prescriptive to say, this is what you have to do and here's why. You're spot on with, he starts off with what he has seen, right? That lived experience where a lot of us, you know, when you're reading that anti-pattern section, you talked about, you know, confirmation bias in the sense of, yeah, I kind of did live this. Like I lived the whole, you know, weaponized metrics. I lived the whole top-down giant whole swag transformation. So it does make it easy to conceptually bounce that against your experience and say, okay, this guy, I kind of get what he's, I'm picking up what he's putting down because it resonates with me in my own personal experience. And at no point does it come across as thou shalt. It's really more of, hey, here was my experience. Here's what I think we should have done better. And here's how you could maybe do it yourself.
And I think that that's a change that we've started to see with more of the invitation kind of aspect of coaching. And so we've seen this change maybe in the last 4 or 5 years where people have gone away from that big bang approach. And we started to evolve in our conversations, right, as coaches and things like that. Like, how do we invite change rather than impose change? And I feel like this whole book has that mindset of, here's an invitation to try some new things. And here's what it might look like for you if you were to try them.
Right, right. I really liked how he introduces complexity very early on. I even think it was in like the introduction to the acknowledgements. He starts talking about Kinevin, and he talks about how he explicitly makes a statement that unique product development, which is what most of us are involved in some way, shape, or form, it truly is an unknown unknown. It is unknowable because you don't know if you're truly being unique. So understanding that, he drops a bon mot later in the book where he asks the question, and I had it highlighted and underlined and circled in red pen. What are you optimizing for?
Yeah.
So what are you actually trying to do? And that is, you know, a lot of us practitioners, when we get together around the water cooler, we all kind of complain. The biggest complaint is we don't have, there typically isn't that North Star. There isn't that idea that we're all marching towards. I thought the idea of thinking about what are you optimizing for is a really good exercise. Mike Burrows talks about it all the time in you know, working from right to left. But he also introduced this word, which I highlighted because I thought it was kind of interesting, the idea of valuativity, which is that what is the soonest realization of the most value with the least output? And when you read that, you're like, ah, I get it. I get it. It's the trite MVP. It's the idea of moving fast and breaking things. It's get myself into small cycles so I can figure out what's working.
Well, one thing when I approach teams or talk to people that are trying to figure out how to do things, I always just ask, well, what's better than what we have now? How do we get to better? Right. And it's funny because I mean, that's the terminology I would use before this book came out. And this book has it in the title, you know, better, safer, sooner, happier. Better value, safer, sooner, happier. So I'd always say, well, is it better than what we had yesterday? And they're like, yeah, but it's not ready. It's not good enough. It's not. I said, but is it better? They say, yes. I say, deploy it. It's better. And tomorrow we'll do something better again.
Right.
And a bunch of little betters will create a lot of tangible value for people.
Right. It's the, there's an overriding human. We're kind of programmed that way to look for perfection, and it's not done and it needs to be done. And agile isn't like baking a cake, right? It's not like baking a cake where it needs to do 30 minutes at 450. Otherwise you may kill somebody with raw eggs, right? It's not, well, I could probably with a couple of beers argue the opposite, but whatever. You do need to make those little steps, like you said, to make it better incrementally. And as long as you can build on that, you're going to set yourself up for success.
Yep. Well, and that kind of takes us into the Kubler-Ross curve, which he has a whole kind of section on change and inviting change and big change versus small change.
Yeah. The idea, the statement of forcing the pace of change will likely lead to real lasting change, either not happening at all or taking longer with more risk. And there's the graphic, Don, that jumped out at me. I have a flag on it, is the change curve, where he actually makes a statement that if you push harder, it's going to take longer and the curve will be deeper, that satir bottoming. And if you, the bigger you try, the deeper and longer that curve cycle is. And that was one of those things where I stepped back and went, wow, I never thought that way.
Well, and that goes back to Peter Senge's book, right? Systems thinking, where he's, one of the laws of systems thinking is the more you push against a system, the more it's going to push back.
Yeah,
it's especially true with when it comes to change, right? And that's why small pushes, small change, or as John Cutler was riffing on quite a bit a while back, is small bets, right?
Right.
Maybe you don't want to bet $1,000 on that thing, but how does $50 sound? Does that sound like something you could risk? And people are like, yeah, I'd try it for $50, right? So in terms of expense of time and energy and output, sometimes people say, I could do the smaller thing, but I'm not going to transform the entire way I work right now.
Right. And like you said, it's the inflict versus invite versus inspire idea of transformation, where he talks about transformation as a mandated program uses old ways of thinking to apply new ways of working, which is it's kind of antithetical to what we're trying to do. And every company most of us have ever worked in, that's how we approach transformation. It's a big bang. Let's move everything. Let's change everything at once. We forget what we know about organizational elasticity. We forget what we know about change fatigue. We forget all those things. And we just kind of push it. And like you said, like Sanky said, the heart, and not only when you push the system, the system pushes back, twice as hard. Right. So that's the other thing where it's like, I'm really taking one step forward and eight back. Is this really worth it?
Well, and that's where clients, right? Companies that hire coaches to come in and transform the organization, that's when they get fatigued too, right? Is that they realize that things start to crumble or to fall apart. I once worked for an employer that came in and they had never had any kind of process whatsoever. And in terms of project management or how they work through projects, right? And so they hired me and said, can you come in and just help us with this and help us fix this? Well, right then it was around the start of my Agile journey. So I started reading and like, well, these new ideas, let's try these new ideas and things like that. And within 6 months, my boss called me into her office. She said, Don, I feel like since you've joined, suddenly we have all these problems. And I said, well, no, actually those problems were already here. I'm just pointing them out. We're bringing them to light.
right. Elevated.
Now we can actually deal with them. And, but that was the fatigue part, right? Is that I was introducing some change or some energy behind that. People kind of got excited by that. We're going to do things better. And then after a while, they just started realizing how much work it's going to be to get there better and how much change it's going to require to get to better. So right. A little bit of fatigue there, but then eventually we did get over that and we went back up on the curve. And, I think we left it in a good spot.
You know, you bring up an interesting, what could be another episode in of itself. It's the idea of Agile coaching as really just agents of chaos, right? Because that's really what you do. You kind of, it's the intended role of an Agile coach is to shake the boggle box, shake it. Rearrange all the tiles, right? And see where they lay now. And then get everybody looking at those tiles with a fresh set of eyes. And to your point, it's not that I created problems. I just found the nomenclature that we could put a name to them and talk about, okay, well, this is what where we have a constraint. We kind of knew it was a problem before, but now we have a word for it. It's a constraint. One of the other things I thought was really interesting in the book, which most authors don't touch on, is an honest assessment of what kind of effort and timeline it's going to take to successfully enact these changes, right? Jorgen Hesselberg talked about it a bit in Unlocking Agility when he talked about, it takes years and 15% of our employee population typically will not make the shift. And that's okay. John talks about, he brings in sigmoid curves, the S curve, anybody who's read Carlotta Perez, technological innovation of financial capital. And he talks about the timeline for successful change, where if you're looking at the 80-20 rule, it typically takes 3 to 5 years with a tailwind, 5 to 7 with a headwind. Right. And that is, and let me know what you think, Don, but I think that's where we as change catalysts typically run into problems, because nobody is thinking that far ahead to be in it to win it for that long. When they hear agile change, somebody thinks, oh, we'll just, we'll use Jira and we'll stand up teams and maybe some trains and we're good. And the rest of us are looking around going, no, this is a marathon, not a sprint. Pardon the terrible pun.
Right. Well, that's the whole idea of, we want to have a 3-year agile transformation, right? And that's what we're going to invest in. That's what we're going to plan for. That would be a 3-year, would get you to the starting point,
right? Right.
A lot of times, because there's a lot of things that are entrenched, especially for these older organizations that have so many systems and everything entrenched, automation, different things that are entrenched in the way the organization does business. You can't just say in 3 years, we're going to be transformed. It'll look different, but it's just a starting point. I worked for a company that went through that big bang. They kicked all the managers out of the room and told them to stay up. Like, they did all kinds of interesting things. And people look back on that time period as kind of chaotic, but also felt like it was positive in the long run. But I also think that it did some damage in a way, in the way they did it. It was so hard-headed, right? And so what ended up happening now is the organization is like, well, we're agile-like. And so I end up explaining to people like, no, actually you are agile. The fact that you're not following it by the book anymore means that you're probably more agile.
Right, right.
As long as you have the right principles in place, that's the important thing. And I'd say that the mindset has changed throughout the whole organization through that process, but it's taken years. And also too, with DevOps kind of transformations and things like that, Josh, in one of his talks, Josh Kurievsky, he said, you know, Amazon, right, AWS, it became this huge thing internally, and then they turned it into a product. He said, but people don't understand, it took them like 15 years to create that.
And yes,
an investment, right?
Mm-hmm. A lot of heartbreak, a lot of argument. Yeah,
right. If you think of DevOps in a 2-year transformation, it took Amazon 15 years to get there.
Right. There's that famous blog post, which I still read every once in a while because it's a really fascinating story about how they went to a API-based service-oriented architecture, where that, you know, the edict came down from Bezos that everything is going to interact with the service. This needs to be done. And if you don't want to do this, I will fire you. And it was like, okay, but they got where they need to be. And as a side effect of that, right? You just talked about as a bonus impact, they found an entire product that actually makes them profitable, right? Yeah. AWS was not, most people don't realize AWS was not a purposeful invention. It was a self-serving invention that they turned and said, hey, we could put this on the market and somebody would probably go for it. And now, I mean, when I look at some of like the step functions they do with the WYSIWYG editors, it's kind of wild where it's gotten, but yeah, it was really just trying to, as a side effect of making their lives better, they created a new product, which is really kind of cool.
Yeah. And that shows the adaptability and all that kind of thing. Right. And make one step at a time. And again, going back to the book, that's kind of how it talks about, you know, the approach to agile, small steps, one step at a time, kind of sense and respond, right? Instead of always having a plan for an agile transformation, it's more of a sense and respond. And sometimes what I tend to do, and you talked about shaking up the box, but I like that the idea of poking around, and you might poke a spot and feel a little give there, right? And say, oh, there's some movement here, I can do this. And then you poke another spot and everybody yells and you go, okay, I won't touch that one.
Yeah, that hurts, don't touch that, yeah.
But you start to make progress by little pokes and little prods and little questions and seeing if you can help people along. The other thing too that I think is good, maybe I'm a little off topic here, but the idea of sharing the mindset and then letting it go.
Yes.
And a moment kind of happens again, and then you share the mindset and then you let it go. And then eventually you hear somebody in the room say, you know what? I think this mindset might be a good approach here. And you say, that's a great idea.
Right. Fantastic. I am convinced that we're literally, our job is basically Johnny Appleseed crossed with the Joker. Right? We're setting seeds and introducing a little chaos and just seeing what happens. And there are times, like you said, well, you'll poke something and it hurts, and you poke something and it hurts less. And then you poke it again and you find there's give because something has taken there. And you don't necessarily need to know what it is, but understanding that there's a little bit of give there goes a long way.
Yeah. It's about what people are ready for. And right. That's probably, like you say, planting those seeds and being patient and waiting for them to grow. Eventually something does change. Something does happen, I think. In the
You talked about better. Early on, we talked about, you know, what are you doing? How can we do things a little bit better? I always go back to Craig Larman in his last class. He talks about how you don't tell people that what they're doing is wrong, because waterfall, it's not wrong. What people did to get themselves in the positions they're in and stature in the company, it's not wrong. It's incongruent with what we're trying to do now. And what we're trying to do now is get that valuativity out the door. And I think that even that small change in wording, where don't tell people, that's not, waterfall isn't wrong, it just doesn't match what the goals that we're trying to achieve now, which is better values, sooner, safer, happier. Speaking of Craig Larman and this book, I like how Jonathan brings up the idea of descaling. And he actually explains it. It's take some of the complexity out of your system before you try and change it. And he talks a lot about dependencies and impediments, which I think is great, because it's one of those things where we typically use the term manage dependencies, which that's probably the wrong mindset to think about. We should be thinking about breaking them, right? Which is truly the idea of cross-functional teams. And I'm gonna tip my hat to Safe, but also take my hat tip back, in the sense of it talks a lot about dependencies, but it talks a lot about dependency management. And I think maybe they might be better served if they emphasize that you don't want dependencies. You don't want to have to manage them. I know that might be a little bit of greenfield thinking, but if it's aspirational and you get halfway there, it's better than you were before.
Yeah, I like to say, if you don't like the answer, remove the question, right? So we have a blocker because of X and we can't do it because of Y. Well, how do we remove that even as a question or a need, right?
Right.
And that's the removing the impediment altogether so that you're not managing it. You're just removing it and can work past it.
Right. Right. Get it out of the way. The impediments are not in the path. Impediments are the path. That's the you know, where it hurts is where you should be going. Because if it was easy, everybody would be doing it.
Yeah. And tying back what we were talking about before with poking and prodding and trying to figure out, the book does talk about the velocity of learning and unlearning, that the transformation can only happen as fast as people can unlearn and as fast as people can learn new concepts and ideas. And I think that's exactly what you and I were touching on with planting seeds, sharing new ideas, inspiring people to think differently, and then seeing how fast they learn and unlearn. And as people start to come on board, then you start to see the momentum shift.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right. Right. And I think the team topologies guys talk about that, right? With cognitive load and how much are you really putting on people? And we do need to be aware of, you know, this changes a lot of us on our agile journeys. It didn't happen overnight. It took a bit. It took a bit of almost doubting Thomas, right? It took a bit of belief. It took a bit of disbelief. It took a couple of cycles to where we finally got to the point where we got it, right? Saul of Tarsus, you know, has the epiphany, he becomes Saint Paul and we're off to the races and now we have Christianity, right? And man, that was kind of a reach of an analogy, but that's kind of where it happens for all of us. And I think sometimes maybe we as practitioners do need to turn that mirror around and look at it and remember that this didn't happen to me in a day either. It took a bit.
You have to remember that some of it feels like illogical, right? Slow down, work on less things. Like those things is like, what do you mean? What do you mean telling me to work on less things? I got all this work to do.
Right, right. We have these strategic priorities, Don. We have to start all five of them now because we committed to them in this year.
Right. So there's a lot of internal, I think, conflict and trying to absorb and you almost need to, that's where that experimental mindset comes in. We're like, let's just try it and let's see if it works or not. This is the theory. Mm-hmm. Let's try limiting work in progress to see if it actually helps us. And a lot of times, at least in the experiments that I did, because I wasn't sure either, right? But I said, it's an interesting idea. It makes sense when you break it down in the theory, the way they explain it, it makes sense to at least try it. And we tried it and we found the effects to be greater, right?
Right. So now I'm in.
Yeah. Yeah. And so now you adopt it. And then the next thing is like, well, this personal conflict with the next thing, but what are the experiments we can try to validate whether that's an idea that actually works in our context or not?
Right? Yeah, right. So speaking of experiments, the one chapter in this book that really jumped out at me, and I can't believe I'm actually going to say this because it's never been an interest point so far in my career, the chapter on safety and how Jonathan discusses the idea of safety. So typically you have an InfoSec department, a data privacy department, a fraud department. You know, I was at Barclays, we had fraud, we had credit risk, we had AML, we had all these different pieces. And typically they're all disparate and you engage them all differently. And you kind of take the QC versus QA approach. You know, for quality assurances, you build quality in, quality controls, you inspect quality into the end, inspect to make sure it's there. And he talks a lot about creating safety teams, which I thought was a novel name in and of itself, of making them cross-functional. So somebody from InfoSec, data privacy, fraud, AML, whatever, and then having them dedicated and aligned to a value stream, right? Have them dedicated to that work, making them more proactive, right? Getting them more involved early on so they can be proactive, creating the idea of risk stories, right? Stories of what typical risks are. And then you talk about the intent and what you're trying to prevent and let the team solve for them. So I love this idea in theory. However, my only question would be, and I would love to talk to Jonathan about how we would do this in practice, is typically those people in an org, there's not a lot of them. They're kind of purple squirrels for you recruiters out there, right? They don't grow on trees. And when they do show up, they're kind of unique and expensive. How would we do this in a giant bank, in a giant insurance company, in a giant telco, right? I think I would love more information about how to build this in, because I think that is a brilliant solution to, Don, we've all been there, the dreaded, oh no, we're going to go live. Did we talk to InfoSec? Can we get them on the phone? Because you know it's, and the poor InfoSec guy has 500 programs on his agenda. You know, he only comes when called, and when he shows up, he's kind of like the Grim Reaper because he never has good news because he's involved too late. So I think conceptually, this is just a wild idea.
Yeah. One thing, when it comes to that kind of thing, I like to think of the idea of automation, right? So how do you automate compliance?
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever your organization has that needs, you know, guardrails, right, for safety. How do you automate that? You know, there's that time when an employee who was kind of new for Amazon took down half the internet with one code change. And people were saying that person needs to be fired and blah, 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 and really harping down on that one individual who was new and didn't know better, right? When the truth is that there should have been a safe environment for them to make a mistake like that and have it get caught before it goes out the door.
Right, right.
So they didn't have a safe environment to work in. That was the real issue, not that this person was a bad employee.
Right, and the fact that for no cost, right, for no cost, meaning you didn't pay someone to find this, he found a major problem. A major weak point, you know, we talk about attack surface when it comes to cybersecurity. He found a major weak point in this first day. And you know, like, what are the odds? What are the odds? Probably slim to none that he found this weak point and he compromised it. So that's the learning they got out of that, right? It's kind of wild.
Right. But yeah, so I like to, you know, tell people how do you make the right thing to do the easiest thing to do, right?
That's a good way to put it.
Yep. And so again, looking for better, right? So you're not going to find perfect to guard all the things, but how do you make doing the right thing the easy thing?
So I like that. Make the right thing to do the easiest thing to do, because then people will naturally default. That's perfect. So last topic I want to touch on, Don, because I think this was an important one in the book, the idea of leadership, right? So as Jonathan talks about, leadership behavior as a culture amplifier, and you want to build a leadership pipeline within your organization. What were your thoughts on this section?
Well, being that I've been now in management for the last few years and thinking, besides being like a transformation type, organizational transformation type person to an actual business leader in the organization, you know, we talk a lot about how to be a good manager, how to be a good leader. And that's exactly it, is to create leaders within the organization, give them the space, give them the time to do that, and also to share the models and the mindsets, right? Which has really benefited me as a manager to have all this agile experience and agile thought, and because it's a lot about empowering people. And that's, I think, what makes a good manager is providing that modeling, what you want to see from them. And that's good, especially if you have an agile mindset. You're going to create organically, you're going to create an agile mindset among the people you work with, right? And then I guess kind of growing and scaling that out. So I always tell people, like, how do we use our leadership here? And I mean that out to other organizations and things like that. Sometimes people are always waiting for the leader, like, well, I'm waiting for the leader to tell me what to do. Well, how about you exercise your leadership in the organization?
Right.
What do you think the organization should do? And some people never thought to be asked that question before, right? But you can empower people to speak up and to say, I'm going to exercise my leadership here, and I'm going to tell you what I intend to do, to use Marquez kind of
language,
right? I intend to do this, and then see if anybody screams. That's what I tell people.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
There's
a lot to come at it. I mean, I came across a quote somewhere where it's good leaders create the importance of leadership, where good leaders create followers, great leaders create disciples, people that truly learn and take that forward. And the example, I mean, the trite sports example I always get is Bill Walsh. He was a great coach. But if you look at his staff went on to be, Mike Holmgren and Belichick and all these really successful people who worked for him, Bill Parcells, I think even. So there's a lot of people, when you get behind a good leader, not only do they exemplify and demonstrate the qualities that they want from their people, you can't help rub off on people. You can't help it. I mean, if you truly find that connection and you create that space to have that connection, there's no limit to what you can influence because you're literally modeling the culture that you want to see.
Yep. Yeah. And I'm reading another book right now called Multipliers by Liz Wiseman. And that talks a lot about leadership and giving up the space and that there are some leaders that are accidental diminishers, right? They're the ones that come in and save everybody, protect everybody, and want to be the smartest one in the room and things like that. And they have good intentions, but they suck all the air.
Right.
Activity and of productivity and of contribution from all the other team members. Whereas the better leaders, kind of leading from the back of the room, right? The better leaders will step back, ask a question, and then just wait and watch what happens. Or ask questions that they don't know the answer to, right? Sometimes as a leader, we'll ask a leading question.
Mm-hmm.
We have a right answer already in our head. But the idea of asking questions that we don't know to try to get the best thinking out of everybody, right? That's what we want in an agile organization is we want everybody at their best creatively and productivity, you know, in terms of being productive. We want everybody at their best. And the best way to do that is to create that safe environment for people to express themselves and to give them the space to be able to grow into that.
Right. The most successful thing you can do as a leader is find a way to turn people who work with you and for you into leaders themselves. That is the literally the gift that keeps on giving. We're quickly approaching time and there are so many more topics. So for those of you that haven't read the book, there are, he touches on DevOps, he touches on tech practices. Martin Fowler comes up quite a few times, the strangler pattern. He talks about making bets, right? Like you talked about with John Cutler, Alan Kelly's OKRs show up at one point. He talks about organizational empathy. And I think we're going to close with, this is a shout out to a friend of the podcast, Claudia, who's been on a few times. This is her favorite quote in the book. And I think a lot of us can close with this because it's brilliant and it makes you think. The quote is, after reorganizing new job titles, ceremonies, the so-called Spotify model, and declaring the horse has transformed into a unicorn, all you will have accomplished is you will have glued fake horns to the horse's head. It will not poop rainbows. And I think that's probably the best quote. And it's a great way to think about what we do. So I'm going to take us out of here on behalf of myself. I want to thank you, Don, for taking your time today to sit in with us. It was great to finally meet you. And we hope this is the first of many productive encounters. On behalf of Don and myself, we want to thank all of you listeners for tuning in once again. Find us on anywhere your podcast is hosted. If you do like what you hear, please give us a review or a rating. It does help other people find us. Shout out to Machine Man Records and Krebs for providing our outro music with no rights. This is great. Eventually we can monetize YouTube sometime. And I think projections is like 2082, but we'll get there. Once again, we are committed to being free, but we do have a Patreon. We also have a new quarterly program where at a certain tier, you get some surprise gifts in the mail. So who knows, maybe I'll send you stickers. I'll send you patches, magnets. Maybe I'll send you my, notes and my Craig Larman Les class worth their weight in gold. So once again, I want to thank Don for sitting in again. And until next time, this is the Agile Uprising Podcast signing out.